This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. We'll continue our series, Candidates with Cal, with gubernatorial primary candidate Kathy Glasson's interview with KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton.
It's our pleasure today to be talking with Ms. Kathy Glasson. Ms. Glasson is running in the primary election to be held June 5th for the Democratic Party nomination as a candidate for governor of Iowa. Ms. Glasson grew up in Spencer in northwest Iowa. Her dad was a truck driver and her mom worked behind a counter at the Sears and Roebuck catalog store. She graduated from Spencer High School and received her nursing degree from the University of Iowa. Glasson is president of SEIU Local 199, representing thousands of nurses, healthcare workers, and school support employees across Iowa. She's a registered nurse who worked in the intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, where she led the effort to unionize her fellow nurses 18 years ago. She serves on the executive board of the 2 million-member Service Employees International Union and has helped lead efforts to organize nurses and other hospital workers across the nation. Kathy lives in Coralville, Iowa, with her husband Matt, a labor lawyer and educator, and is a proud mother and grandmother. Kathy, would you tell us something about yourself that we won't find on your webpage or with an internet search?
Wow. Okay. Thank you so much for that introduction. I think people probably don't know that I was a single mother and raised my daughter and understand the struggles that everyday Iowans are going through right now with low wages, child care costs that are like $900 a month. I understand the struggle of everyday Iowans out there, and we sure have those. And so I'm proud to be a candidate running for governor because I know Iowans want a governor that's not going to put party and politics first, someone that's like them and understands the challenges that they face every single day. I'm proud to be a candidate running for the highest office in Iowa.
As you talk with people across the state, what are their most frequent concerns?
What's clear to me is that folks are struggling. The facts are that we have 381,000 households in this state. That's nearly one out of every three Iowa families struggles to make ends meet every single month. And it's because two-thirds of the jobs in our state pay less than $20 an hour, and then half of those pay less than $15 an hour. And then they work, and they work two and three jobs. They come home after very long days of work, and they still can't pay their bills. You know, we need strong unions. We need to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And we need to make sure that Iowans can afford their health care, which is a number one concern of a lot of the Iowans that I've talked to as well.
Assume you're elected. What specific actions are you going to take to make a difference in those things that you've heard about?
Well, my first day in office, I'm going to call on the Iowa legislature to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour as their first order of business. And that raise would kick in over 3 years and then be indexed to inflation moving forward to help struggling families that I just described. And then we need to strengthen and expand union rights in this state because changes to Chapter 20 collective bargaining that occurred last legislative session, we need to restore union rights and reverse the damages that they caused last year. Honestly, winning back those union rights that we lost isn't enough. We need a governor who's going to step up and stand up to corporations and make it find new ways to help workers join in a union, because that's how working families get ahead in our state. And we need a governor with a spine who's going to stand up and fight to reverse the misleadingly named right to work laws in our state. And as a Democratic candidate running for governor, I'm going to challenge my fellow Democratic candidates that say they're for the labor movement and labor unions and workers. I'm challenging them to step up and say they're going to stand up and reverse right to work laws in our state, because that's the only way we can strengthen unions in the state of Iowa and give workers a voice on the job.
A number of people have indicated some concern about our water quality. We've got 8,000 pools of feces around this state with our 8,000 confined animal feeding operations. What can you do about that?
In this campaign, I came out very early in the campaign saying that Iowans deserve clean water. Clean water should be the birthright of every Iowan. And we do have 750 impaired and polluted waterways in our state. That's nearly half of our waterways are polluted. I came out bold and stand to this very day in this very minute saying we need a moratorium. I will fight for a moratorium on the growth of factory farms until fewer than 100 waterways in this state are polluted. And then we need to fully fund the DNR to make sure that those huge confinement feeding operations and the waste management, they're held accountable so that we have enough investigators and regulators making sure that those huge operations are complying with laws and regulations to keep our waterways clean. And when they violate it, we need stricter fines and penalties on those huge corporate agribusiness that have taken over the land. A lot of our farmland in Iowa, and fully fund DNR and make sure our water gets cleaned up and make them pay for the pollution they cause, not the taxpayers.
One of the things that's been of great issue lately has been the Medicaid and mental health situation in Iowa. Is there anything you can do to help that?
Oh, well, I'm a registered nurse, and I've seen this firsthand that the for-profit insurance, health insurance industry will always, always put profits over patients and people every single time. That's how they make their money, is by denying care. Medicaid privatization in the state of Iowa is a perfect example of why we need to get the for-profit insurance industry out of our health care. It has been a disaster from the get-go. Patients aren't getting the care they need, and providers are not being paid for the services that they're providing. The first thing I'll do as governor, and a priority in my administration, will be to reverse the privatization of Medicaid. That's the first step. But I'm a candidate that believes that that's not good enough. We actually need to lead on passing a universal health care plan. And I support Medicare on the federal level, but I don't know that we can count on the politicians in Washington, D.C. to do that. So I, as governor, stand on passing a universal single-payer plan right here in Iowa to cover every Iowan, including reproductive and mental health services. Everybody in, nobody left out. Iowa will lead the way when I'm governor of the state of Iowa.
I've heard some folks talk about that, and others who've said, whoa, how can a single state go on their own with something like that?
We can't afford not to. I've talked to too many Iowans that say their premiums are skyrocketing, copays are outrageous. We absolutely can do this, and it will vastly lower costs for healthcare for Iowans versus what they're paying now. For example, I talked to a woman who told me that her premiums just for a single plan, $1,100 a month. That is not affordable health care. It limits the ability for them to live a good economic life and be able to afford the other things that they want to buy and help our economy. So we absolutely need a universal single payer plan, and we can't not afford to do this, honestly, and we need to make that happen. Iowa can lead the way, and we should.
In order to do that, would you do kind of like North Dakota has done with the banking? I believe they have a state bank. Would you establish a state insurance plan then?
Well, it would be the state of Iowa would negotiate directly with the providers of care in the hospitals. So, and that negotiating power by the government actually can lower costs and stabilize the market. But yet everybody gets the care they need when they need it, and they don't have to pay their bill. As far as a state bank, I can see a state bank helping farmers with low-interest loans and student loans in the state of Iowa. So I'm very interested in the model in North Dakota that they've been using. I hear it's very successful, so I think we need to take a look at that. But covering the cost of health care, I think, needs to come from the fact that we absolutely need to get the for-profit insurance industry out and lower overhead costs. We absolutely need to – Iowa can draw down federal dollars from Medicare and Medicaid to help fund the health coverage plan that I'm talking about. Then we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour so that we have more revenue coming into the state to fund health care. And let's talk about the huge corporate tax breaks that we give businesses and corporations in this state that absolutely do not need those tax breaks. And let's put that money into the things that we value, like health care and fully funding public education and higher education in the state. So there's multiple ways to bring money in to pay for the cost of the universal health care plan. And we're building support for that in every 99 county. We want Iowans to support a single-payer plan that will be effective for them and lower costs.
One of the things that seems to be a barrier to what you're proposing to accomplish is the huge amount of money flowing into the electoral process.
Well, I'm a strong believer that we should reverse Citizens United. I also believe that we should have publicly funded elections. And that would take the stranglehold that corporations and huge business interests out of the mix so that everyday folks have the ability to, A, run for office and get the corporate takeover of our electoral process out of the mix.
You mentioned a good education, and we've certainly felt the cuts on the education budget. What are you going to do for that?
Every public school should be the best public school in the state of Iowa, and that's what we should aspire to. I support fully funding K-12 at 6% over the current budget levels, and I will veto anything less than 4% K-12 funding. And the reason I say 4% as the veto level is because that is what Iowa used to invest in its K-12 and our public school system. We need to reinvest in our students and our teachers so that they have the resources they need to make Iowa's public education system the quality education that it was before we had folks that didn't prioritize it in office.
Illegal drugs, of course, are always a problem. On the other hand, we have a big problem with prescription drugs right now. Is there something the state can do about that?
Yes, absolutely. And as a registered nurse, I know part of the problem with the infusion of the highly narcotic medications that are being pumped in our communities come from major pharmaceutical companies that know that those medications were extremely addictive. And actually now the studies are showing that they're not even that effective in reducing pain. I think and I support that the Iowa Attorney General's office is involved in any investigation into the big pharmaceutical companies that actually intentionally sold these as a safe option for people's pain control. And Iowa needs to be part of that. And as governor, I support that. The opioid crisis, which is extremely dangerous, and we've seen death rates and overdoses in the state of Iowa increase, we absolutely can take steps to prevent that. And one of those things is we have a prescription drug monitoring program that's in place right now in Iowa. We've had that for a while. The problem is that only 43% of prescribers participate. I believe we need to make sure that prescribers of these highly addictive medications actually have to enter into the prescription drug monitoring program. It needs to be mandated. The program itself needs to be updated so it's user-friendly. It's not at this point, so we need to invest in that. We also need to make sure that we have Narcan, which is the antagonist to opioids and narcotics, so more readily available. I've talked to pharmacists and healthcare providers that very few folks are accessing Narcan to save people's lives. And then we need to pass Good Samaritan laws, which mean if you're with someone that has an overdose of a narcotic, for example, and you're involved with that, you aren't going to be criminally charged for reporting and saving someone else's life. So we need to pass Good Samaritan laws. And I support harm reduction programs, needle exchange programs, being able to return your narcotics and without, you know, without being pulled aside and charged with having narcotics. So I just think there are much smarter steps we can take as Iowans to save lives and have a common sense approach to making sure people are healthier.
What I'd like for you to do is tell us what else you'd like to say.
I will be a governor that believes in co-governing. I put experts in the room that know these issues, like, for example, around public education, health care, clean water, agriculture, climate, environment issues, which I have some of those councils in place that are advising me and helping me develop a policy to be a good leader in the state of Iowa. So I'm very proud of that. We haven't talked about climate change, which is so important because if you look at the weather here in Iowa in April, we're having snowstorms and winter storm warnings that, you know, are pretty unusual for this time of year. Iowans know we've seen droughts and the flooding in our state. We've experienced it and seen it. We've had over 200 devastating oil spills in this country in the last 3 years. I just want to be clear where I stand on environment and climate. I do not support growing or expanding any of the pipelines in the state of Iowa that carry oil across our state. It is not the future of energy, and I don't support pipelines. I don't. I think clean energy is the direction and the future of our state. And we need to invest in green energy and get to 100% clean energy economy in the state of Iowa. And that's by investing in. We've done a good job on wind energy. I think we need to invest more on solar and develop that as well as biofuels. We can actually change the direction and turn around the significant changes to our climate if we take this on and are bold about it. And I also don't take PAC money from gas, oil, and the coal industries, and I'm proud of that.
Well, thank you very much, Kathy. It's been our pleasure to be talking with Ms. Kathy Glasson, a Democratic Party nomination candidate for governor of Iowa.
Great.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Cal, for having me. It was really great.
In case you just tuned in, we've been listening to gubernatorial primary candidate Kathy Glasson's interview with KHOI reporter Cal Halliburton. As part of our series of interviews with primary candidates from all parties. This is the second Candidates with Cal interview with Democratic candidates for governor who responded to our request. We're turning now to local history. A couple of weeks have passed since the news that all Yonkers stores would be closed. For a few days, the pages of the Des Moines Register were full of stories about people who recalled the elegance of the Yonkers Tea Room as it was 50 years ago. There was nothing quite as special about the historic Ames Yonkers, but its departure gives us an opportunity to reflect on how it represented the changes in local shopping patterns over the past 60 years. First, we checked with Alex Pfeiffer when he came in with his April report from the Ames Historical Society. I'd asked him about a volume entitled Yonkers among the local history books on its shelves. Here's the discussion that followed between Alex, Maggie Westfeldt, and Ursula Rudenberg.
Yeah, it's one featured in our gift shop. So it's not one we produced. It was actually written by Vicki Ingram, who's done a lot of research on the Yonkers store through the last century and a half, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so that's something we've got available as a new item in our gift shop with a very small limited amount of them. So if you are very interested in there, I recommend coming down and picking one up before they might be gone, just like the Yonkers stores, unfortunately.
Yeah, I might have to do that. Gosh, Yonkers has been
That's a piece of history that a lot of us grew up with.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, they're one of, I think the cool, you know, everyone's used to a lot of the department stores, the Woolworths and stuff, but Yonkers is really cool because it's actually in Iowa. Department store, you know, it started, if you're not familiar, it started in Keokuk back in the, I think, 1856, which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably older than what, like 95% of the cities in the whole state, I imagine.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go in. I'm not even a big shopper, but not having Yonkers there, I'm going to go into withdrawal, I think.
So tell us a little bit about Yonkers. I mean, a lot of us, myself included, you know, going to Yonkers and down on Main Street was part of life. So it's just amazing to see this disappear. Tell us a little bit about the business.
Yeah. Well, and we kind of, you know, maybe some of you aren't familiar before of Ames' shopping district before the mall, but that was Main Street, our nice little Main Street down here. So, you know, I think that when I went and looked this morning, I think the Yonkers first started in Ames in between 1942 and 43 is when I was kind of seeing it in the phone books pop up. I'd have to dig a little bit deeper to see if we could find that opening date. But it's kind of amazing that they opened up the store even during the war years, during World War II here. It's kind of really amazing. But they had – basically, we had what would be now the – 300 block of Main Street was really the main department hub shopping center of Ames. Mm-hmm. We had
Pennies was
Yeah,
here.
Pennies. Mm-hmm. Well, those of you who are not familiar where Yonkers was, it is in the building that is now occupied by the Salon and Delavie, the wine bar. So those two storefronts, well, building was eventually kind of chopped up and reorganized in many ways, like a lot of buildings on Main Street. They find new purposes and new ways to make them work. So that was kind of the main area right there, that near that Burnett corner, everything that was kind of like the department block. We had Yonkers, and then on the same north side of the street, right next door, you had Montgomery Ward.
Right, right.
And that'd be where American Country is. And then next on the corner where Everett's was, they had the Montgomery Ward Farm Store where you could get some more industrial-type things. And then you said across the street was Penny's, where we have it's the pitch roof building with the Main Street Magic and random goods in it. And then even a couple doors down, we still had Woolworths over where Old Main is today. So if you needed anything in Ames shopping-wise, that was a pretty good block to start on, I would say, back then. I mean,
That's right. And if you came to Main Street on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning, streets were packed.
Yeah.
Packed.
And I think they also had Thursday night shopping. Wasn't that the big night when all the, like, the farmers would come into and everyone kind of just hung around downtown? Mm-hmm. And then we get the mall in 1971, and that's where most of those department stores then find their future home, you know? Mm-hmm. Yonkers is one that moves up there. Penny's.
Do you know anything about the family that owned Yonkers? They were an Iowa family?
Yeah, I know just a little bit. So it was three brothers. They were of Polish-Jewish descent. And they started it in Keokuk. So they basically came like right over the river when the state was kind of founded, and in the late 40s, 50s, and got this little, just a little general store for Keokuk going. And then it soon became big enough that they opened a major one in Des Moines. And that kind of became the central hub and what they called like the original store. That was the one that burned down in 16 is when that burned down in that fire. And, so we lost – and that was – I think that building was built in 1899, if I remember right from looking last night.
Had the wonderful Yonkers Tea Room.
Yes. The Tea Room was really the big draw to that building. That's what everybody always mentions is the Tea Room there.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
was opened back in – I think 1913 they opened that up. And it went until something like 2005.
So Yonkers kind of distinguished itself as a department store with a certain amount of class, right? They aspired to a certain standard.
And Friendly, apparently. The Friendly store was their nickname.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Susan Franson. We have been listening to a discussion of the history of Yonkers and what downtown Ames was like when it was there. And then came the North Grand Mall. When Yonkers moved to the mall, Main Street entered a major slump. To describe that transition, we called on Marg Junkin, recently retired owner of Cook's Emporium, to describe the changes in shopping patterns she has experienced as an Ames resident and later as a Main Street business owner. When did you come to Ames?
I first came in 52 to go to school here.
What was Main Street like in the 50s and 60s?
In the 50s and 60s, it was mostly, in fact, it was all owner-occupied stores or businesses of various types. They were all aimed primarily at women, with the exception of Car Hardware, and because that's who did the shopping in those days for the most part. There was Tilden's, and there was another store called the Fair Store that both sold dry goods, which means fabric and things like that, which women bought a lot of in those days. There was Car Hardware, and it sold basic hardware items. And then there was Yonkers, which was a large department store, or large for Ames, and Penny's right across the street from it. And I can remember taking my children into Penny's. They had the kind of cash system where you put the money in the little box or container and put it into a system where it zipped along up to a central office. Remember those?
Yes.
And when my children were little, they just thought this was fascinating. They wanted to go into Penny's, and they stood there and watched the system go. It was nice because I could shop.
Actually, I think that technology is still in use in banks where you have the drive-in bank and you
have to put
your money in round container and put it in and it shoots underground. But
yes.
In those days, of course, it was much more exciting because you could see it above ground.
It was up there on the ceiling going around. It would come back with your change.
So you said they were owner-occupied. You meant those?
For the most part,
The most part.
Penny's, of course, was a large department store, as was Yonkers. But other than that, they were smaller shops.
They had a big drugstore, as I recall.
Yes, there was a large drugstore, Fasco Drug. There was a major change in downtown Ames, would have been about 71, when Yonkers and Penny's both moved out and moved up to the new mall, which was a big new concept at that time. And so it left downtown kind of lacking. And for several years after that, downtown was not what I would call in good shape.
When Penny's and Yonkers moved to the mall, meaning an awful lot of people in Ames that I talked to,
thought that downtown was just finished and it was just terrible and the mall was the only way to have shops.
Well, of course, it was new, it was different, and malls were big. You know, all the towns were getting a mall. Des Moines, of course, I'm sure it probably, I think they'd had one for several years. And finally, Ames was getting one, and wasn't this just wonderful because it was the latest thing?
And it was also the place where the kids hung out. I remember when there was a snow day, and this, I think it was the 70s, and we had all the kids from high school went out to the mall for the snow day. They couldn't go to school, but they could go to the mall.
Well, of course, yes. I mean, and you certainly didn't want to hang around home. Well, there was space outside the stores in the mall itself where people could hang out, not actually being in the stores. And so they didn't particularly bother the businesses that were there. Whereas downtown, if it was raining or cold or snowing or whatever, why, nobody wanted to be outside. And so they congregated in particular stores and were a nuisance.
Since the occasion of this discussion is you're retiring from Cook's Emporium,
okay,
let's talk about its predecessor.
Beverly's Gift in China, which originally was Lucille's Gift in China. They didn't carry much in the way of actual kitchenware. They carried more china and table linens of the more formal types for the most part. And she also carried some what you might call accessories, I guess, for the home. Things like candlesticks and decorative bowls and things of that type. They didn't carry what you would call a lot of things that actually pertain to the kitchen very much.
But I remember when you opened, it was a different kind of household shop. And there's this gradual change. Mm-hmm. Brides used to buy very expensive china and, you know, was their, quote, good china.
That's right.
And then they had an everyday china, and they received these mm-hmm. as wedding presents. You have a bridal registry. What do brides get for wedding gifts?
We used to carry some dinnerware patterns, nothing in the way of what you would call fine china, but that's pretty much gone by the wayside. They register for a wide variety of things. A lot of them do register for cookware of various types. A lot of just miscellaneous items, maybe a popcorn popper, maybe a waffle iron. Well, for one thing, nowadays, most couples wait until they're at least 25 or maybe closer to 30, and they've already set up a household, and they have acquired various household items.
Now, do you have any sense of what was happening with each of these transitions? When they had discounted, I guess, kitchenware shops that often had very interesting things at very good prices.
Sure.
Nice casual china for very little money.
That's right. Yes, you can.
And I would think this would be just very big competition. But you're still in business, or I should say your store is still in business.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you account for your survival when you have this kind of mass competition?
We aim at an entirely different customer, the customer that wants quality, whereas the other stores are carrying dubious quality. For example, on one occasion, I had a gentleman come in. He had purchased a coffee pot and used it for a month or two, and it had gone to the point where it didn't work anymore, so he took it back. They gave him another one. Same thing happened again. And so he came into the Cook's Emporium and he said, now I want something that's going to last me long enough that, you know, I don't have to be buying a new coffee pot every 2 months. And so we sold him a coffee pot and I said, okay, if it doesn't last at least a year, you be sure and come back and see me. I didn't see him, of course. We sold quality items. And then another thing back in the beginning, the reason shops of the type Cook's Emporium is, there were a lot of them that started about that same time. And many of them lasted a few years and then went out of business for various reasons. I did a lot of research about such things when I was getting ready to start the store. And I wasn't sure that Ames was quite big enough to support a store of that type. Well, as it turned out, it was, because the people in Ames are people that, you know, want quality. So it turned out that I was right. But some of the bigger stores, Williams-Sonoma had started at that point in time and became a large national chain, which it still is. But the whole movement towards interest in food really started after the Second War, when the soldiers came back from all of the various countries that they had served in, France, Germany, Italy, and while in those countries, and the Asian countries too, they had experienced the foods of those places. And they wondered why they couldn't get something like what they'd had over there. That's when things like pizza first became popular in this country. Italian immigrants had had pizza before that, but they were looked down upon. Of course, they were immigrants at that point in time. Oh, they ate that Italian food, remember? Not something that the average family in this part of the country ate. But when the soldiers came back and they'd had it in Italy, they said, hey, we want some of that stuff too now. And so look where pizza is now. You can find it on every street corner. Then Julia Child came along, and she was another factor in an interest in cooking. French cooking became very great interest to a lot of people, cooking and doing something different than the same old hamburger dish, roast beef one night, meatloaf the next, and pork chops on the following night kind of menus. And so people started wanting to know about different foods, how to prepare them. In fact, that's how I started out, was teaching in the adult ed program here in Ames, and I taught French cooking. Found that there was interest, like I would say, hey, you know, you can make a quiche in a pie pan perfectly well, it just looks a little bit different. And, oh, but we want a quiche pan. And that's really what led me to think that maybe Ames was ready for this type of store. We still sell quiche pans.
We talked about the decline of Main Street. But in the recent years, the mall has declined, and the mall is struggling to...
Oh, yes.
It's not like it used to be, even though the interior shopping in this climate really has a lot of attractions. But at Christmas time, people, you know, fight the snow, and they come downtown to shop.
Oh, yes, they certainly do.
You have watched the revitalization of Main Street.
Right. Downtown, you can pick up on trends a lot more easily if you are a small operation than if you're a big one with lots of people that you have to please all the time. Then everybody, of course, has a different idea. But we are constantly changing the merchandise mix on some of the things. If a new gadget comes out, why, we can order it. And meanwhile, it's been on TV, of course. You know, whichever program you watch, you see, oh, this new thing that does whatever. New peeler, a new mixer of some sort. We can get those quickly and easily. And so it keeps it an interesting store because there's always something new coming along.
Well, there's something else, a huge trend in retailing, and that, of course, is online shopping.
Yes.
And I have been told that there's some shops, like Gilger's and Ames Silversmithing, that do a lot of online business.
Yes.
That people order their custom-made jewelry.
Oh, yes.
For example,
there is a violin shop.
Yes, and that they custom make for customers who don't live here.
Yes, they do.
So how does that affect your business?
It definitely takes away from our business because people can sit at home and, you know, they don't have to get dressed. They don't have to find a parking place or anything like that. And they can easily order on the internet whatever they think they might want. And so it definitely has affected that. On the other hand, there's a lot of people that say, well, I really want to see what I'm getting. They're tired of having to pack up something that came and isn't at all like what they wanted and send it back. Also, the small shops like Cook's offer services that you don't necessarily get that way. They offer gift wrapping, and they will usually ship your gift things. You know, we have a customer maybe come in and say, hey, I've got this recipe and it says I need a whatever it might be. Do you have that? Oh, yes, we have one. It's right over here and here's how you use it. And, you know, help them with whatever it is that they want to do as far as making some dish. I think that's why we still see a lot of people coming in.
You are doing something now in your retirement that I understand was how you got started, and that is teaching cooking.
That's right. That's how I got started. Yes, our new owner is very happy that I'm continuing to teach classes and do demonstrations there, because that's what I enjoy doing, is helping people learn to cook something new and different, get some new ideas, how to cook things so that they'll taste good as well as be nutritious and healthy and things like that. It's fun. And
you were having weekly cooking courses at Cook's Emporium.
We have a weekly cooking demonstration every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And each week it's on something different.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Susan Franzen, speaking with Marg Junkin, longtime owner of Cook's Emporium, to describe the changes in shopping patterns she has witnessed over the decades while Main Street was recovering. Our next guest, Cindy Hicks, director of the Main Street Cultural District, will pick up the story of the turnaround on Main Street.
I would say that that probably started with the National Trust for Historic Preservation around 40 years ago when they developed the National Main Street Center. And the reason that came about is there was a concern across America that we were losing the history of our small towns. Quite often, when you looked back 100 years ago, the place where the community gathered, the heart of the community, was in the center of town. And as we became more mobile as a country, highways were built, cars that could go faster and further were developed, people started moving away from that center of town. It was an urbanization where people were on the outskirts of town and they wanted their land and they wanted a big mall, and that wasn't in the center of town. You had old buildings that needed repair. They weren't as efficient to run as a brand new building, and so people started moving away from them, and you saw a trend of small towns across America boarding up their historic downtowns. And the National Trust for Historic Preservation saw this as a crisis, that they needed to save the history of our small towns. And that history is often in the downtown. And so from that, the National Main Street Center was born. Main Street, Iowa came to being out of the National Main Street Center. So our state organization is Main Street, Iowa. It's over 30 years old. And so it kind of trickles down, then you get to Ames. And I can tell you that when my husband went to college at Iowa State University over 20 years ago, he said that Main Street in Ames was not a place you would go to. Bill Malone, who owns Cafe Diem, said that when he opened his coffee shop on Main Street over 15 years ago, that you could walk outside on a Friday afternoon and look both ways and not see any cars. Now you come downtown and you can't find a parking place. And why did that happen? Well, in 2009, our Main Street business owners, community, and city leaders came together to save the Main Street, to save the history of Ames, and that's downtown Ames. They joined the Main Street Iowa program, and we became a Main Street community. We've been nationally accredited for 9 years, and it's a slow incremental process of saving your buildings, saving your community. It is economic development through historic preservation. And there were a lot of things that have helped this. So 40 years ago, when the National Trust for Historic Preservation started the Main Street program, they never could have foreseen the millennial. And when you look at what is saving our Main Streets now and what has brought about the resurgence of Main Street, it's really the millennial generation.
How's that?
Well, millennials have everything at their fingertips. They have technology. They can shop online. They don't need to go into a store to buy something. However, they want the experience. And when you want the experience, you don't go shop necessarily at the mall or at the chain store. You go to the small, unique store you find on Main Street. You stroll down through the history. You stop in the small mom-and-pop coffee stores because you want the experience. At the same time, millennials are also very conscientious about having a sustainable lifestyle. And so when you live in a historic downtown and you're walking to work or you're walking to school, you're living in a densely populated area, you are living a sustainable lifestyle. And millennials are very much about that. And so when you look at what has caused this resurgence of Main Street, I believe that you can look at the millennial generation and see that these young people who are now getting into their 30s, have saved our history of our town. You look at people who grew up watching TV shows like Friends and Sex and the City and the glamorization of the urban lifestyle. And people like me, I'm in my late 40s, I grew up watching the Partridge Family and shows that glamorized living outside the city center. The young people didn't grow up with that. They grew up with a different type of media. And so you have all of these things that have come together that have brought people back to the heart of the community. I often say in Ames, when I want to see somebody I know, I go downtown. The community of Ames, the permanent community of Ames, when they want to go somewhere, they come downtown. And so it really has become the gathering place in Ames. There is live music every single day downtown somewhere. I walked here through the farmer's market this morning, first day of the farmer's market, and it's packed downtown. Time is at 9:12, and you would have a hard time finding a parking place downtown because people are here. They're excited about spring. When you want a good locally owned restaurant to eat at, you come downtown. When you want a locally brewed beer, you come downtown. And when you want to see your friends, you come downtown. It's the place to be in Ames. And I really am proud to be the executive director of such a thriving place. I walked into an area where I'm not working to build it up from nothing. I'm working to sustain it at this great level and make it even better.
Cindy Hicks, director of the Main Street Cultural District, has concluded our local Ames Main Street story with an account of its revival. Though this is a particular Ames story, Main Street, Iowa, has been important for many towns in our surrounding area. In the time remaining, Ursula Rudenberg will invite you to an afternoon of tea and discussion with Kirsten Anderson, whose $1.7 million lawsuit for her wrongful termination after the Iowa Senate Republican caucus fired her over her complaints about sexual harassment. The event will be at St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church on Saturday, May 12th from 2 to 4 p.m.
Thank you, Susan. We are excited to announce that Kirsten Anderson will graciously hold an event to benefit KHOI. It's going to be an afternoon tea, a comfortable and informal gathering where Kirsten Anderson will discuss sexual harassment in the workplace and the hostile work environment. It's an opportunity for you to come and express your own ideas about this very timely topic, ask questions, or just to listen to what other people have to say. Please consider joining us. It'll be a really exciting opportunity to hear firsthand from somebody with the understanding of really having walked the walk. This is also a great opportunity for you to help KHOI. One of the reasons we're doing this event is because we want new members. We want more people to discover KHOI and to become part of the family that is supporting community radio in Central Iowa. So if you know somebody who would be interested in this topic or you think would benefit from this topic, would you consider bringing them and help us to introduce new people to KHOI and this beautiful thing of building community through communication? Speaking of communication, last December, KHOI reporter Joy B. and myself interviewed Kirsten Anderson, and I wanted to share an excerpt from that interview just to get a sense of the energy and the intelligence behind and the difficulty of what she did. Here's Kirsten Anderson explaining what happened.
I worked as the communications director for Iowa Senate Republicans for 5 years. And throughout that time, I was harassed, bullied, and retaliated against. On May 17th, 2013, I formally complained to my boss in the form of a memo. 7 hours later, I was terminated.
Can you explain what you mean by bullied and harassed?
The harassment that I experienced, it was pervasive, mainly perpetuated by a coworker, but also I experienced it from the senators that were elected into office at that time. And it was in the form of pornographic images on state computers. It was verbally, also, in the form of dirty jokes perpetuated by the staff and senators, and offhanded comments, comments about women's anatomy, comments about Senate Page's dress, comments about my dress. I complained 4 times. It fell on deaf ears. Nothing really happened when I did complain. And so I had had enough, and I filed a formal memo and was then fired.
And what was the reason given for your firing?
Insufficient work product. The GOP Senate leadership still maintains that to this day, but this summer a jury of peers found otherwise. I sued the state of Iowa. We had 3 main tenets of my case: harassment, retaliation, and intimidation. Mm-hmm. And on all 3 counts, I was successful.
What gave you the inner permission to speak out about this and to follow through?
Well, this had been building for quite a long time. I mentioned I complained multiple times during my tenure as a state employee, and it fell on deaf ears. And finally, in 2013, I had had enough. I knew that the intimidation and the bullying that they were doing to me, the scrutiny on my work product that had been exemplary in the past, was suddenly questioned and nitpicked. I was being yelled at constantly. I would come home crying that I was being forced to come into the office 10 o'clock at night to fix problems that could be rectified the next morning. Things I knew were wrong. I had had enough. I wanted to make the Iowa Senate a better place to work. So I complained 1 last time, and I was fired. And the decision to bring suit against the state, it was a tough one. My name was being dragged through the mud, and I wanted to fight to make it right and make a better workplace for Iowans. Just because these people are elected officials, they make our laws, doesn't mean that they are above the laws that they make.
It seems like you wanted to protect other people that were working there now and in the future. Did any of those women come forward when you made the complaint or after you were let go? Did any coworkers contact you?
Sadly and interestingly enough, the coworkers that still work there didn't want to experience what I experienced. They didn't want to lose their jobs. They're fearful. And I don't blame them for that. Everybody stays in a job for a different reason, and you can't fault them for that. And we're still friends, and we've been through a lot together. They still want to work where they're working. I want to help make the environment better for them. They have gone through an internal investigation. They weren't going to release the results. They now have, but it doesn't say a whole lot because it was an investigation conducted by fellow Republicans. And I think harassment is not Democrat or Republican. It's both parties. And if you're going to do an investigation, let's do a thorough job. This is an issue big enough that needs to have a light shined on it. And I don't think a bright enough light was shined on this investigation that was conducted at the State House recently.
What is the story that you're coming away with from having undergone this culture?
I'm coming away with positivity. I think it's good that this story is being shared. I think this is really the tip of the iceberg. I should note that it's not just women who face this. It's minorities. It's people of different ethnicities. This is a power and control thing. This is not a weakness, and there's no shame. There's a lot of shame and a stigma associated with being harassed. And women should not feel that there is shame in this, because there's a whole slew of emotions that people go through. You know, like I mentioned, I was to the point where I was crying every day on antidepressants. Things were simply bad.
What was your understanding of why people were doing this to you?
It was not a reflection of me, that this was power and control over me. You know, it wasn't my so-called poor work product. Who knows what it was? I'll probably never know. So the story I'm taking away is that, you know, now that we're talking about it, and I want us to continue to talk about it, the stigma goes away. We have constructive dialogue. We talk with the men in our lives. We can have safe, productive work environments in Iowa and throughout the country, for that matter. It can and will be done. I know that it's coming.
And we're speaking with Kirsten Anderson, who experienced sexual harassment and apparently other forms of harassment at the Iowa State Legislature and really became a national story when you sued after being fired. Since then, have you continued to engage with people about this issue?
Yes. I recently gave my first talk to a group in Des Moines, and I'd like to continue to talk to groups, educate them on how they can have constructive dialogue on the issue. Because I think education is key. We shouldn't be fearful about this. If you don't know where to draw the line, how can you move forward with a productive work environment? And everybody deserves that, truly. Everybody deserves a safe work environment, and I feel passionately that we can make that happen. So I'm looking to advocate for Iowans, women, and minorities on this issue.
Would you take this opportunity of being on our community radio station to communicate what it is that you think is most important for people to understand?
I think it's most important for people to understand that they can't remain silent about harassment at work. If you feel uncomfortable about something that was said, a joke that was made, it's okay to say that you felt uncomfortable. There's no shame in that. We need to bring respect and decency back to the workplace. I think it comes down to that. It's basic respect that we're extending to one another.
Do you think it's important to know the rules of the workplace, too? You feel empower people to know their rights?
You bring up a great point, and that's another key tenet. Read those policies. Read that handbook. Educate yourself. Know what's going on and what is and is not acceptable at the workplace. Know your rights. Know your recourse. Know the channels that you need to go through if something is happening, if you're being bullied or retaliated against or harassed. Know who to go to in HR.
And what do you say to a person who says, I understand my rights, but I can't afford to be fired?
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of ladies, and for whatever reason, they're too scared to come forward and complain, and they just have to take it. And I get it. That economic factor is huge, and that's why most people who experience harassment stay and simply take it.
What does that do to you when you take it?
Mentally, it's awful. It does terrible things to your mental state of mind. It's a dark place, truly. You think you're alone and the world's out to get you, and you're crying every day. You can't think how to get out of the situation, and something just snaps. You need to have that support system in place to get through it. Definitely. Find a support system. I was really blessed with a wonderful support system in my husband, son, and family and friends, and I recognize not everybody has that. So reach out to people you feel safe talking to about this. And, you know, I think in Iowa we're experiencing sort of a mental health crisis. There's more visibility into it, but as funding continues to reduce for mental health in general, we're going to see more problems. It's not going away.
The actions you took were not in relation to the Me Too movement, were you aware of that movement when you did this?
No. So I was fired 2013. You know, this has been a 4-year long legal battle for me. And the timing is just crazy. I think that this is the tipping point, what we're experiencing right now. We need to continue to talk about it, get comfortable with talking about it. That gives me a lot of pride and joy, and it just fires me up to help other people going through what I experienced, because this is a brighter light that's shining on the issue.
That was Kirsten Anderson, who won a $1.75 million lawsuit for wrongful termination after the Iowa Senate Republican caucus fired her over complaints about sexual harassment. Join us as an active participant or just to listen when to benefit KHOI. Anderson will lead an in-depth, informal discussion about sexual harassment at work. She'll be at St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church at 2338 Lincoln Way in Campus Town from 2 until 4 p.m. on Saturday, May 12th. Again, that's Saturday, May 12th, 2 to 4 p.m. at St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church. And it'll be an informal conversation about the topic where you can participate or just listen to what other people have to say. We're looking for new members, so please bring somebody along who doesn't know KHOI and might be a valuable addition to the family that supports community radio in Central Iowa. This is going to be a tea hosted by Donna Prisgintis and Lana Noctegal of KHOI's very own Donna Lana Kitchen. Let me just give you a little preview of what they're planning to serve at this tea. Rosemary lemon cookies, lavender scones, raspberry gelée, fudge candies, walnut brittle, almond biscotti, tarragon lemonade, and tea from Littlewood's Tea Shop. We also want to thank Access Assault Care Center for partnering with us to get the word out about this exciting event. So one more time, that's Saturday, May 12th, 2 to 4 p.m. at St. John's by the Campus Episcopal Church. That's at 2338 Lincoln Way in Ames. It is a fundraiser for KHOI, so bring somebody that you think would be excited to discover KHOI and to become a member. And we're so appreciative of Kirsten Anderson's willing to support community radio.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today. Other voices you heard were Kathy Glasson, Alex Pfeiffer, Maggie Westfold, Ursula Rudenberg, Mark Junkin, Cindy Hicks, Cal Halliburton, Kirsten Anderson, and Ursula Rudenberg. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There, you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.